Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week, from Monday through Thursday in the United States, 7 till 9 Pacific, that's 9 till 11 Central, and 10 till midnight Eastern. And for those of you in Greenwich Mean Time, I pity those who have to stay up as well. Good thing you have a methamphetamine problem in your country. My very special guest is Michael Cross. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Benny. It's a privilege to be on. I think it's been 3 years since the last time.
Well, for the refreshing of my memory and, of course, the introduction to the audience, would you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Okay, well, first of all, a little self-plug. I would encourage people to go to my website at michaelcross.net. There you'll find a little bit of a biography. I am an educator, also an author. I've written a series of books, 3 books published so far in the series called Freedom from Conscience. And I also host my own radio show at UCY-TV Productions known as Unlock the Door, where, doing a little bit of alternative radio on the side there to help inform the masses of where we're at and where we're going, unfortunately.
Well, firstly, I'd like to ask you what actually got you into your now chosen career path, and then after that, I wanted to inquire what is it that you're really passionate about? And would you like to talk about that?
I'm passionate about a whole lot of things. Actually, I've taught psychology for over 2 decades, so I've always been passionate about psychology, finding out why people act the way they do, and basically trying to get down to understanding the mechanisms by which people interact with the society, but also the way the society interacts on the individual, which I get very passionate about that. That's one of my favorite subjects. So that was a big inspiration for doing my book series, which essentially, that sounds kind of ironic, but I have a book series in which the main character is a young female, and she's essentially a psychopathic anti-hero, kind of in the vein of maybe the Charles Bronson Death Wish movies, the main hero in that show, or the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns in which basically you're portraying a psychopathic character, but the character is doing the right thing. And essentially you need someone like that to go after the bad people that are in the plots of those films, and that's essentially what I do with my book series. So, essentially, what I thought would be very interesting is for people to understand the way that psychopathic people see the world, and therefore be able to see how maybe our politicians and world leaders and financial leaders also see the world, because essentially a huge percentage of those people have that personality characteristic. And we can go into a lot more detail about why that is. As we go on,
it comes down to desire, essentially, and the who's going to stop me sort of thing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I found something very interesting. It was one of the inspirations for writing the book series, is that most people believe that everyone sees the world the way they do when they're thinking of politicians, policemen, influential people, the ones that rule society, but also the ones that carry out their orders. They often, I guess it's natural for people to think the best of each other. They think that they see everything through the lens of their minds, and it's not true. It's absolutely not true.
Well, how can they believe all of this? Well, it's so blatantly untrue, I mean.
Well, first of all, I think we have a tendency to believe that, well, we want to believe the best in all people, ultimately.
Wait, hold on a second.
That's why we get so perplexed about oh my gosh, how could this person be doing this? Or how could this, you know, this organization be doing that? And so, in a sense, it bewilders people. They are confused.
Can I just say something? I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I heard a story yesterday about what people eat for comfort food. What they eat for comfort food is what their parents gave them when they were feeling sick as a child or something like that. So it gives that positive correlation. This is the reason why people believe they're lying politicians, because they see them as a parental figure and gain comfort from believing them, believing that they're there to protect them.
Absolutely. What you're talking there is basic Sigmund Freud 101. With the comfort food, it's an oral stage thing. And when it comes to the way that we project out and see the world is essentially based on the way our parents, the image that we gave. I mean, Freud, again, in his work, Civilization and Its Discontents, he goes over this in great detail. In fact, he goes over the idea that the guilt that a young child feels when they break the rules, for instance, and they feel that kind of negativity because they're disappointing their mom or their dad, that gets projected out in about 99% of human beings towards society as they grow older. And they, you know, the normal progression is for a child to start out being socialized in the family, and then the smaller community around them, and then projection out into the main population. Now, I say 99% of people feel guilt because, like I said, if we're dealing with psychopaths, that percent, about 1% or 2% of the population, has a very limited or even non-existent idea about what guilt really is. They don't feel that. So when they do something, they don't sit back and mourn and actually, you know, start tearing themselves up individually, subconsciously. They don't, it doesn't depress them if they've done something bad. Instead, they may have goals that they feel bad about not achieving, or an ideal about their self-image, but it is not something that causes them guilt. But, you know, 99% of people, they do feel guilt. And many of those 99% feel an extreme amount of guilt if they do something wrong. They break a law, they disappoint someone, or go against a social norm. And again, you know, psychopaths will go in, like I said, we get into way more detail. They don't feel that. So to them, a social norm, doing something bad, it's very Machiavellian. They look at it like, well, maybe I should do this. You know, maybe it's better to be nice because it gets me my goals versus, well, I'll be mean and not get my goals.
What fairness is there and what justification? Is it kind of like, what? Hold on a second. We're talking about a completely different game set, aren't we? We're talking about apples and oranges. They're just not the same frickin' fruit. The same rules do not apply. There's these things called moral obligations, ethics, empathy, honesty, integrity, honor. Are you saying that these people do not possess these and only, shall we say, copied and perverted mirror images of it that almost appear like it's there, but it's just not?
Well, I think you've got it right there. There's a whole bunch of different traits that go into psychopathy. You just mentioned empathy. And a psychopath, for instance, and I have several articles, like I said, at michaelcross.net. A psychopath can have sympathy. And I think all human beings do. If you see someone run over or you hear about a really bad event, you can sympathize, like, well, I wish that wouldn't have happened. That makes me feel kind of, well, not good. But that other aspect called empathy, the idea that you can kind of put yourself into the shoes of the other individual, in psychopaths, that's very limited. It may exist for what you call first-degree relatives. They may feel a certain level of empathy for their husband. I always say it this way: their husband, their wife, their mistress, their children. They have it for very close people, but not extended out into the general population. So to them, the same way that a behaviorist would look upon their lab rats running through a maze. They see human beings in the same way. So in a sense, if you look at someone like Edward Bernays, who was able to really separate, I would say, ultimately ethics from humanity, because he was the father of modern advertising, and therefore he was always in the process of manipulating people.
He was the advertising shoehorn that just kind of eased us into a jackboot.
Well, yeah. If he wanted to get someone to buy something, he knew how to manipulate them because, he was both the cousin and the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And, it's like those kind of marriages.
Do you reckon Bernays was actually a psychopath himself?
I don't know him. I don't know much about him personally. I've just seen some interviews where he, when he was like over 100 years old, when he did a David Letterman or one of those kinds of shows. But ultimately, I think it would be at a real big advantage to be a psychopath and the father of modern advertising, because he knew how to manipulate people. Just the whole idea of getting women to smoke. Okay, that's one of his crowning achievements. Getting women to smoke by selling them the idea that smoking was a way to show feminism, to, break into the man's world. You can smoke and get lung cancer just like the men do.
That's called suffrage, bro.
Yeah. Well, he was able to link smoking and the suffrage movement together. And he sold lots of cigarettes doing so, because there had been a prohibition against women smoking before he did his little thing at a parade where he gets a bunch of women to show up and start smoking, and therefore gets lots of press, and therefore breaks a major taboo.
He also invented product placement, got women smoking in the movies and silent films, mm-hmm. and Nickelodeons of the time.
Well, yeah, and if we look at it today, that seems to us like so obvious that you would do that. But in his day, it was totally not obvious. And he went beyond that, too. I mean, with the whole smoking thing, he also, because the company he was working for had a green packet for their cigarettes, and women didn't like the color green so much at that time, he was able to make contact with other people in the fashion industry, for instance, and say, this year's line, this is all in preparation for this. People don't understand just how well they're manipulated out there. It's not just a, oops, this worked. No, there a lot goes into it. He, for instance, went out and got the fashion designers to start showing lots of green dresses that year in preparation for his little Torches of Freedom display that would then combine, smoke this brand of cigarettes and also the idea that it was liberation. And people just totally bought into it, thinking, this is a way that I could show that I'm part of the, in those days, the 1920s, and I'm a free woman. And you had the urbanization and the whole mass production thing going on. And he used that in so many different fields. He designed the breakfast foods of the Western world through advertising and doing all of these things. I mean, before Bernays...
There was a waste pork product called pork belly that was like riddled with fat and everything. And so what they did is they sliced it up into thin strips that they called bacon, which nobody wanted to buy. And Bernays did a massive advertising campaign because everybody had eggs for breakfast. So he linked bacon with eggs as the ideal breakfast. And there you go. Now, what you're saying there is kind of cluing me into the long-term influence of this man. And most of the general public have never heard of Bernays. They think it's some kind of salad dressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or pizza dressing in the Nordic countries, which it's not one of my favorite foods. Yeah, the thing is that one of the things I think that was really profound of what Bernays said in his book, which you can find online, it's called Propaganda. It was written in 1928. And one of the first things he says in that book is that people's taste, their values, their perception of life in general is not dictated by themselves. It's ultimately dictated by a small number of people who you never hear of. It goes beyond the politicians. It goes beyond those kind of people you see on TV. It's people behind the scenes that actually set the agenda for the politicians, the ones that are doing the marketing, the ones that are playing with the public mind, trying to find the right words, trying to put the product placement in. And everyone gets this idea of, oh, wow, you know, this is what's trendy. These clothes are trendy this year, not realizing that the fashion industry has planned obsolescence. If otherwise, you know, everyone's had a teacher that's worn the same clothes for the last 30 years, you know, clothes.
Unfortunately, we're just going to have to quickly go to a break now. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Michael Cross. We'll be right back. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Like Bob Marley, we are jamming, and I hope you like peanut butter too. And my very special guest is Michael Cross, and we were talking about Edward Bernays and the planned obsolescence and everything. And, you know, one of the arguments for planned obsolescence that I heard was the population growth. If the population's growing and there's not a whole bunch of useless, meaningless tasks to keep them occupied, repairing stuff that breaks down all the time or producing stuff that gets thrown away all the time, then humanity would currently be in chaos because, oh, the economy would just collapse if everybody was, like, fed, clothed, and sheltered without the need to continually rely on the replacement of all of that crap from interstellar corporations with no frickin' conscience!
Well, corporations are psychopathic in and of themselves. If you look at the definition of a corporation, you apply that to a human being, which in America, a corporation is a human being according to law, then you essentially would have a psychopath.
Yeah, and they tend to cluster. And I say this all the time. Why is it that the subject of psychopath comes into my mind almost every day? You know what I was just thinking, Michael? Is I'm a bit narcissistic, right? If you look down at, if you know me real well, and I know myself pretty well, I look down all these character attributes of narcissists, and there's a lot of real nasty attributes that I don't have, but there's a lot of kind of benign attributes of narcissists that I am, that almost define my personality, right? And I think this is why I hate psychopaths and hate really bad, malignant narcissists a lot, is because they exude a lot of the same behaviors that I do, but they don't have any of those rules of conscience or ethics or empathy. They don't have creativity. They have everything that is bad about me and nothing that's good, and they make me look bad. And I look bad on myself, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, when it comes to, you know, narcissism and psychopathy, which are very related to one another, those are personality disorders. Everyone has aspects of any of the personality disorders. And all a personality disorder is, it's not a mental illness. It's just we all tend to kind of cluster one way or another in our various personality characteristics. It's just that certain people, they cluster a lot into some areas. And it could be like borderline personalities, schizotypal, and of course, psychopathy. And
well, so the one thing I want to explain this is that it's a bell curve. At a bell curve, you've got everybody in the middle. Well, most people in the middle will go like that. But on the very edges of the bell curve, you've got people who are so minute, small in number, but are very, very different from the general trend.
Absolutely. They stand out like a bell curve on intelligence. You've got people that fall into a very, you know, like mentally retarded. And on the other end of the curve, you have people that are geniuses. Now, when it comes to psychopathy, you have to score, well, it depends on what country you're in, a certain level on such things as the Checkley list or the Hare psychopathy list. The thing is, there are some people that score high, but they're not quite there, and so forth. And essentially, it sounds like, I mean, I'm not making any diagnosis. It sounds like you have enough empathy that you understand humanity in other people, and you might feel bad about manipulating them, but you can at least have enough of certain traits to be able to to be able to understand the psychopath and how easy it is to manipulate people in general.
And how easy it is to become one of them if you're not careful.
Well, I don't know. Well, yeah, you can jump into what they call secondary psychopathy. You can start displaying those traits more and more and more. But ultimately, I would say there are some people that score, you know, if they take the test, you can just look it up on the internet, you know, the Hare psychopathy checklist. And most people score about a 0 to 5 on that. Then there's a group of people that score between 15 and 25. And then, of course, the ones that score way over 25, well, you know, they're obviously diagnosed psychopathic. The people that score kind of 15 to 25, though, are those kind of people that, well, they have enough empathy to understand people, but sometimes not enough empathy to care about what they're doing. Perhaps Bernays was sort of in that. It's also somewhat of an advantage. If you're a hardcore, you score a complete 40 in psychopathy, you might kind of lack that ability to really get into people's heads and be able to move them. But if you score maybe a 21 or a 22, then what I like to call, and I don't want to confuse it with borderline personality disorder, I would call that borderline psychopathy, in which I think a lot of our politicians fall into that category, maybe even the majority. I don't know how you could even be a politician in the modern world today and not fall into that category.
Well, it comes down to desire and power and control in terms of job mm-hmm. position and title is almost the prime drive. And so naturally you see clusters. Like, as you say, there's only 1% of the population. But the problem is 1% of the population are bureaucrats, politicians, military people, and intelligence officers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But we're not talking, I'm not saying like all of them are. What I'm saying is that they're overrepresented in those particular industries where their food is, you know? Like if like a lion sticks close to the zebras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the food source. And ultimately, another really dangerous aspect is that a society can become, and I forget the guy's name right offhand, it's early in the morning here. It was a Polish researcher, and he came up with the idea that when you have psychopaths in control of a society, people learn that that's how you get things, is to mimic psychopathic tendencies. You call it something like political panerology or something like that. And I think it's very dangerous that when psychopaths are in control of a society, you get a very Machiavellian view of such things, of everything, but especially foreign policy. You know, the whole Machiavellian idea that whatever will get you your aims is okay really is, it fits perfectly with psychopathy, and it seems to be what we go by today in the Western world, especially, that, you know, if you get your goals by acting nice, that's great. If it takes a little bit of underhanded things to get what you want, so be it. And if it comes right down to, you know, go bring democracy, quote unquote, to a population by bombing it into the Stone Age, then that's okay as well. Whatever suits what you want to get your foreign policy aims, you know, Machiavellianism, psychopathy, it fits perfectly. Go ahead. That's okay.
All right. Well, what my interest was is exactly the process in which you take an ordinary, decent human being and you get them to that point where they will commit atrocities. Now, you're familiar with the prison experiment where they had those students play guards and play prisoners?
Yeah, the Zimbardo studies,
Well, Zimbardo came up with the 7 social processes that grease the slippery slope of evil. You know, and I love the way he words things, and it's mindlessly taken the first small step, followed by the dehumanization of others, then the de-individuation of self, you know, anonymity, like wearing a mask or something, nobody can tell you who you are, diffusion of personal responsibility, just following orders, blind obedience to authority, I've got an orders to follow, uncritical conformity to norm groups, or group norms, you know, and last one is just passive tolerance of evil through inaction or indifference. And what struck me when you were speaking is this, this seven slippery slopes. Oh my God. If you were to look at the current populace and their generalized behavior, they're starting to score relatively high on these slippery slope scales, don't you think? And This leads me to believe that psychopaths are not only in control, but are getting more and more control faster and faster than ever before.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. I'll bring up a real strange irony here in just a moment. But yeah, the people have a real desire to fit in. I mean, Nietzsche pointed out that to go against the tribe is something that only a small percentage of people can do, and it makes you feel bad, and you know, you'll be scorned, but it's, you know, that's the price you have to pay to have your own soul and your own individuality. Again, he thought that was only a small percentage of people, the Uberman type people, who could actually do that. And yeah, society, people learn what to do to get along, and they'll just kind of fit in, because ultimately most people just kind of want to conform. You see that in politics. You get a small percentage of people on the right that take part in politics, a small percentage on the left that take part in politics. They're both well-informed. But then you have a middle ground where basically it's a competition to get that little group in the middle to vote for you because, well, your candidate has the best smile or the best slogan. You know, I mean, that's essentially what democracy has come down to. But ultimately, yes, people will do what they feel they are supposed to do. They will conform to that. Now, the irony that I was going to get to was the fact that ultimately in a society, and that's why I write my books the way they do, in which the main character is, you know, you fall in love with the character because she's doing the right thing, is that ultimately psychopaths are the ones who are the least likely to conform. So in kind of a weird sense, you can have a child who's growing up and he's seen or she's seen the world deteriorate around them, but it might be that the psychopathic person is the one who has the ability to say no and not do those things. There's actually been some studies that have shown that people that do things, you know, out of the ordinary, like if there's a woman being raped, they'll step in to her defense. Often those people score very high on psychopathic tendencies, whereas 99% of the people might walk by and say, oh, I hope someone calls the police to stop this. But they don't do it. It's a very small percentage of people that actually will step in and take a risk to their own selves to do something right. The unfortunate part is that when you place people who are attracted to politics, that are attracted to power, you know, that have this personality, and you give them this kind of power, they start learning how easy it is to deal with the 99% and how to move them along in whatever directions, because the 99% of the people, they are kind of, unless they have good ethical principles behind them, you know, they have something that they could say, no, I will not do this, then they'll do it, whether it's for their job, whether it's because they feel bad about going against the crowd or whatever. They will do it. And that's a dangerous situation for a society to be in, ultimately, when things just get pushed more and more and more. We see this in America with police and the whole militarization, and now you can go on the internet and see thousands of videos of what, you know, most people would consider police brutality, but it seems to be normalized. It's getting more normalized and normalized and normalized to the point that I used to warn people visiting Russia, for instance, you know, kind of avoid the police when you're in Russia. And now when I hear people saying, yeah, I'm going to go visit America, I'm like, well, try to stay away from the police at all costs. But that's only been through like 10 years of that change in mentality that has come because the government has said, well, no, we have to make sure that our police are acting like military people. And Zimbardo's talked about that whole thing. I think he had a video called something about evil or something. If you put in Zimbardo and evil, you'll find a talk he gave about this, that people just kind of accept what's going on. And, well, if it's a good society, then they'll do good. If it's a society starting to gravitate more and more and more towards a Machiavellian ideal, they'll act like Machiavellians.
You know that Seven Slippery Slopes of Evil thing I just read out? Well, he came up with another slide. I don't have it, unfortunately, but it's about the characteristics of heroism and who is likely to actually jump in and be a hero. And I think it's sort of like embodying the both worlds is what it takes, you know, to have seen or been in the middle of evil or to be capable of it is the only thing that will actually allow you to risk your own life in order to stop it happening to other people, kind of thing, you know, because it's almost like you have a broader understanding of other people, and I think you take a greater responsibility because your knowledge of scumbaggery is greater because you've got experience in it.
That could work. Yeah, that could definitely work with some people. There's others that might be motivated by other things. Like I said, many of the people we admire as presidents, for instance, we think, oh, they were heroes and so forth. If you look at how they score on psychopathy, people like FDR in the United States, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, they all are people that are very admired by the American public. And yet they're the ones that score the highest when it comes to seeing how they if you're doing the whole dark triad appraisal, they seem to be the people who employ those kinds of traits.
Maybe if the worst kind of a scumbag you are, the less trouble you're going to have spreading countless quantities of BS to everybody, tell them what they want to hear so that they love you and continue to support you and then re-elect you. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with my very special guest, Michael Cross. Don't you go anywhere. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, very special indeed, is Michael Cross. Now, I wonder, you said it's very early in the morning. Do you mean like when somebody's out late and they've been partying, or it's real early in the morning, like it's 4 o'clock in the morning and they haven't slept? Or are you talking about it's real early in the morning, like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning when you normally get up at 10?
Well, I'm at it's 4 o'clock in the morning. So I guess some people that are night owls, this would be just kind of late in the night, versus people that get up in the morning, This is early in the day.
Now, we've just recently gone through daylight savings in New Zealand, right? And you know how daylight savings knocks you out for almost like a week to a month or something until your body clock reshifts to the light and dark and what time things are? Yeah, it's kind of a real bugger. I've been finding it very difficult to do my work. Just exhausted.
Yeah, I spent some time in China, so the time change was not as dramatic for me because I've been suffering jet lag for the last couple of weeks. But yeah, I see how that works.
Now, I was wondering as well that we were talking last night with a friend of mine about video games, and video games can teach you anything. You know, they can teach you maths, they can teach you geography, they can teach you Japanese. But you know what video games are teaching people in the main, like the vast majority of video games? How to kill. And do it very quickly. And I think about the influencing of society. You look back, it used to be like a deviant act. Something you could go to jail for if you took like a picture of a naked woman sort of thing back in the day. Today, hardcore pornography, worst torture movies ever seen by mankind, these things that were shunned and punishable with extreme punishments back in the day are now so commonplace as to be quaint. And I think that what's happening is society is being influenced very, very, very slowly in a nice little process to gradually make us accept worse and worse and worse realities. First through it virtually, and then once we've become assimilated into that kind of virtual world where anything goes, then it'll start appearing in our real life, and we won't be upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is pedophilia going to be legalized next? You know, that's my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope not, but what you're talking about is a process of desensitization, that the more we see of something, the less it really phases us. It's like, and this is kind of ironic, that one of the professions that psychopaths do very well in is emergency room doctors. They tend to gravitate towards that area versus general practitioners tend to have an extremely low level of psychopathy in that profession. But if you think about it, an emergency room doctor, if you come in with you're holding one of your arms in your hand because it got severed in an accident, he or she can kind of dispassionately think, okay, well, here's how I'm going to go about fixing your arm without freaking out psychologically, going, oh my gosh, you know, this is, you know, they feel so much empathy that it immobilizes them. And you know, you just think about all the weird things that an emergency room doctor has to see every day. Now, a lot of people couldn't handle that. But the problem is that many people could still get used to that sort of thing through desensitization. And I personally believe the more you see of something, the less it will affect you. Like, I'm trying to think of an example here. Well, I've heard that...
I've got a perfect example. Watching surgical footage. The more you see of that, when you first watch it, it's like, oh my God! And then there's the flesh and the blood and the bones and the pulsing and the, oh God, and you almost feel sick. But by the 10th time or whatever, you're like, oh yeah, that's a very interesting and intricate procedure.
Although you still, the average person still feels a level of empathy towards that person that they're working on, no matter what, versus someone who's psychopathic is far less likely to feel any empathy towards that person. They can still feel like, well, I want to fix this person because it's my job, or if no one dies on my shift this week, then I'm going to be recognized as being the best doctor or something like that. I think they found that back in World War II that – I think it was the Marshall Studies – that over – it was like something like 90% of soldiers refused to shoot. Even if they were on the front line, they wouldn't shoot at the enemy. They fired above their heads. They didn't fire at all. And there was a small number of people that actually accounted for the kills on the battlefield. Whereas most people were just like, okay, well, good. He took out that bunker. You know, I don't have to do it. It wasn't cowardness. It was just that people had this sense of, this is wrong. I can't kill a human being. So what the whole process of boot camp is not to get a soldier in shape. That's, you know, that can be done with just giving them an exercise program when they first join the military. Boot camp is to get rid of your individual self and make it into a group entity, and also to train you through the whole stimulus response routine that when a target appears, you shoot. You know, stimulus is the target, response is firing. Very, very B.F. Skinner.
It becomes muscle memory, not unlike how a martial artist trains.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the problems you have with police brutality in the United States is they're training the I almost said soldiers, that's a Freudian slip. You're training the policemen in this same process. And many of them are veterans too, so they've kind of come through this. And so now you see these situations, these horrible videos where someone questions the cop and all of a sudden, you know, the cop's firing a gun at them or hitting them, just like the Zimbardo studies. You had, it only took a little over a day before you had a student abusing a fellow student because the student that's doing the abusing has a prison guard uniform on. And therefore, they take on the role of what they perceive as the prison guard. And just like nowadays, you put a uniform on a cop, worse yet, you know, you've got a rally. You know, on anything, you know, be it environmentalism or just human rights. And then you dress the cops up in black uniforms with the riot gear. They look like something from a dystopian movie.
And where do you think they got the ideas, bro?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I like this one movie. It's called Equilibrium with Christian Bale.
Oh, yeah.
around 2001. When it came out, it was a very good kind of modern version of 1984. Now it seems more like a documentary. It's though if you watch it now, it's like, whoa, this is where society is going. This is where much of it already is there, where the cops are dehumanized and they dehumanize the people around them. That's a very dangerous trend. I mean, in a sense, we almost have, even though it's not totally accurate, you've got psychopaths making the laws, sociopaths enforcing the laws. And that's a very dangerous trend in any society.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you're talking about American police brutality, it's the thing about being an American. I mean, having had so many conversations with some of the best and brightest Americans of the world, the ones who are traveled very well sort of start to see the same problems that their own country has everywhere, but just to lesser or greater or different degrees, with different accents, different labels and things like that. You know, you step off the plane and here's the such and such branch of the New World Order of New Zealand, you know. And talking about police brutality, since 1990, 1,433 people have suddenly died following contact with the Royal New Zealand Police, and not one police contract has ever, you know, not one policeman has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter, ever. And this is happening while the corrupt government is threatening you with terrorism, which are statistically 8 times less likely to kill you than the cops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds a brilliant marketing ploy of a Bernaysian style to me.
Well, the thing is, the word terrorism carries certain emotional context to it. And Bernays understood that. I mean, if Bernays was around today, he could totally explain it. That, you know, the word, a word itself, when we learn our language, we learn it in an emotional context. You know, when you hear the word mother, it all of a sudden, all the listeners are thinking something about their mother. Well, when you say terrorism, you're going to get images of people blowing up innocent children in a school or something like that. But now you hear this word terrorism just applied to anyone and everyone. And it could be minor things. It could be a kid showing up to school in America, you know, 5-year-old with a squirt gun. And all of a sudden, they're suspended because someone says, well, this is violating our zero tolerance law where we're trying to curb terrorism. And you're like, what? You know, that's terrorism? But it still brings up a certain connotation.
Well, not to mention, fascism and communism are forms of government if you look them up under the dictionary. And terrorism's in there as a form of government as well. A government that threatens you into doing its will. Sound familiar? We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 2 of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because, I mean, after all, just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest, Michael Cross, enjoys discussing a whole bunch of the behavioural characteristics of the people who think nothing of killing a person. I saw an interesting documentary once about psychopathy, and the woman portrayed this scenario about how much empathy a really bad psychopath would have to an average person that is not their friend, not their family. Have you ever had a cold and you got up in the morning and you blow your nose and you toss that Kleenex into the trash basket, right? You ever make it to the office and you think to yourself, oh my God, I really destroyed that Kleenex's life. I scrunched him up, I covered him in goo, infected goo even. He'll never be the same again. No, you don't think like that? That's how much empathy a psychopath would have towards you after destroying your entire life. In fact, they might meet you some other time and they'll remember you fondly, you know, and just go, oh, hey, how's it going? You know, that kind of thing. This is somebody who stole something massive from you. Maybe got you fired from your job or swiped an idea off you in the boardroom and then threatened you to not say anything. You know? Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's unbelievable is because you're not a frickin' psycho. If you think like one, on the other hand, just sort of put yourself in their shoes for a minute. Suddenly the world starts to make a lot more sense.
Well, it's sort of like how we would react. I think an analogy we could employ here would be, how will we in like 20 or 30 years react towards humanoid robots? You know, if you... towards the robot. And that, to a large degree, is how a psychopath sees biological entities, fellow human beings. And that's, you know, if we look at a society scale.
Like the Terminator, it doesn't feel pity or remorse, and it absolutely will not stop until you are dead.
Right. And in the same way, corporate leaders who in the last, I think it's like 25 years, refer to populations as human resources. I mean, you'll get this kind of stuff coming from international bodies like the World Bank or the IMF. They'll look at economic impacts on an area, and they don't refer to things in a personal sense so much as it's statistical. And, you know, you talk about, you know, I like your quote there, the lighter side of genocide. But ultimately, the people that are in control tend to look at things from those standpoints. They look at things from a cost-benefit analysis. I was just reminded because I saw an article about Madeleine Albright. And it was just praising her. Oh, she's such a, you know, wonderful symbol for women in the 1990s. But I cannot get out of my mind that interview she did on a news program in America where they asked her, are the sanctions on Iraq, which have resulted in those days under the Clinton administration, resulted in, I don't know, 100, 200,000 Iraqi children dying? And she replies, well, if it's achieving the foreign policy objectives of the administration or whatever, I mean, to me, that is like, whoa, you've just said that on a cost-benefit analysis that, you know, children perishing are part of the equation. And when a company moves its factory somewhere where it can pay sweatshop wages and pour toxic chemicals into the rivers and so forth and have no safety provisions within their company, and they just say, you know, they're just looking at like, okay, well, we can maximize our profits by moving our plant from whether it be New Zealand or the United States or whatever to some country that we can just get away with stuff that you would read about in Upton Sinclair. I mean, Sinclair wrote the Jungle. To me, that's psychopathic. That to just not care about what the results are.
You know, and then when you sort of like that that philosophy. It's only illegal if you get caught.
Oh well, it's only illegal if you get caught, and also the people that are in charge are willing to prosecute you. I mean, that's a big change nowadays. There's a lot of stuff that today people just accept as normal politics, whereas in 1970, I mean, come on, you know, Richard Nixon, if you look at what he did today and you show some, I don't know, school kid, you know, about Richard Nixon, and maybe they've heard some little thing in a social studies class that, oh, he was impeached for unethical this or that. And then you say, well, wait a minute, here's what he did. And they look it over, most of them be like, is that all he did? Because our standards have gone way down since 1973. Now, when a politician does this or that or whatever, we're just kind of like, okay, well, you know, is what's the next reality show on TV that we can watch?
This reminds me of when I was in a geography class studying coastal erosion. It doesn't matter how hard the rocks on the coast are; the sea just keeps beating at it, and beating at it and washing it away until there's virtually nothing left but a skeleton of what it once was. And the same principles are being applied through advertising and marketing and political games and whatever the hell else you really want to point a stick at to weather and away our humanity.
And human beings can easily be manipulated based on playing on our desire to be good and to do the right thing. There was a video that I share with classes, and it has a guy who works for some sort of population control center, and he's talking about how they integrate themes in soap operas in places like Latin America, in which they show small families as the norm. Things like getting married later or all these kinds of things. And we might think, well, maybe that's a good thing if, you know, their population is growing faster than their infrastructure can maintain. But ultimately, what I thought is interesting about it is not so much the desirability, but how they go about it. And they understand that they can decrease fertility by showing people images on TV. They don't come on and say, well, we need to reduce the birth rate in your country by this much to gain these economic advantages. They don't do that. They understand that what works with people is emotions. So you show the happy family with one kid, or, you know, the person living this particular lifestyle, and so forth. And then people are thinking, oh, well, I want my kids to have lots of things. So
it's monkey see, monkey do, you know?
Yes, yes. But this is not just some little thing like, you know, this is planned. This is all programmed into the population.
Why do you think they call it television programming?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. It is people. If you ask a person, name 10 leaders of various countries in the world, the vast majority can't do it. Even well-informed people can't do it. If you ask them to name 10 characters from, I don't know, The Walking Dead, and they'll be rattling off like, oh yeah, this person was in season 1 and 2 and 3, and then she got killed and blah, 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 blah. They could do that very easily. But, you know, I mean, it has a major impact on people when they watch TV. It is their social circle.
I think somebody determined that television is addictive. Or was it? No. It was the CIA that found out that mind control is addictive. Mm-hmm. And so if you're watching television and somebody takes it away from you, it's like somebody taking away your favorite toy as a child. You almost throw a tantrum. You go out of whack. And people need to throw the frickin' television out. If that they're showing you, you don't want it. It's like going to a gas station, man. You cannot find anything in a gas station that is healthy, okay? Even the bottled water has fluoride in it. All right? There are no lettuces, there are no tomatoes, there are no nothing like that, okay? It's all bad for you. Don't go and get food from the gas station, just like you don't go and get your entertainment and your information from a television.
Well, the thing is that I think what's interesting is that even though, what is it, the average kid in America spends like 4 hours a day watching TV.
It's actually 8 hours a day now.
It's 8? Oh, no wonder we have an obesity epidemic. The thing is that it's very, very, very rare for schools in America, the public schools, you know, grades 1 through 12, to have any kind of curriculum that addresses media literacy. It's just not there. And yet this is such an integral part of people's lives.
Well, they also no longer teach civics. And the last ones to go is history teachers. Apparently they're the hardest one to find now. It's like a dying educational platform. Oh, nobody wants to know about history, you know. How important could it be?
Yeah, yeah. So essentially, you know, you're training people and then they go home and they watch TV. And, you know, or when they're not at home watching TV, they're on their iPhones and they're keeping up on whatever, I don't know, One Direction's doing in on their social media. Or any other number of music groups or celebrities or whatever. And it's just ultimate programming, and people don't understand, though, that there is marketing behind it. I mean, at least with my kids, I don't tell them they can't listen to their music or they can't do this or this or this. I just remind them that, well, do you think these posts about this singer, do you think her fans are just putting this on, or who is putting all this stuff out to publicize her? I want them to understand that there is it's a corporation that does a lot of this kind of stuff.
There are layers embedded in the signal.
Oh, of course. And even when you watch TV, you know, these talk shows, I mean, I won't name any by names, but you know, you have the talk show where the person comes on and they're talking about their family troubles, and then the talk show person will give them some advice, and everyone in the audience cries and claps their hands and so forth. But the interesting thing is, watch the credits at the end, and everything down to the shoes, if it's a female talk show person, to the tie, if a guy, everything is sponsored. Everything is, you know, there's something behind it.
It's called Edward Bernays, who invented product placement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you got a target audience as well. And in marketing, I mean, there's actually psychologists whose job it is to advise marketers on what 3 to 4 year old children prefer when it comes to colors and shapes in their advertisements. So they'll go then nag mom and dad to buy them that product. I mean, it's down to the point that we're being manipulated in all areas, but yet we just kind of are immersed in it. We don't think about it any more than when we're swimming in a lake. We start thinking about the, oh, I wonder what kind of fish live here and stuff like that. We just swim in the lake and, you know, get out, dry ourselves off. Advertising and media, all these things are the same way. And you know, people will watch these TV shows, especially the ones that are designed for the TV consumer. I will have to point this out. There's two types of programming. Yeah, I like that. You know, programming that's done. One is for people who TV is just an escape. It's a fantasy. They're usually higher educated people. And usually their TV shows come from the cable networks that make them specifically for a higher educated audience. And so that's just escapism. Oh, I'm going to sit down and watch this program and just kind of forget everything and immerse myself in this fantasy world. And usually they don't watch that much TV. Whereas then there's the main consumer, where television becomes their life. And they're the ones who really get enthralled in it. And if you watch these programs, if you know how they're designed, and you can see the propaganda that goes into them, you can see the messages. They don't see the messages. They don't see that, well, do you think that this is what this person's whoever wrote this show is getting this across because they had these statements made, or this kind of character was the bad guy, and the bad guy said these things, and it was all part of a kind of propaganda. And they're like looking at you like, hey, can't you just accept it and have fun? Well, they don't realize they're being totally programmed and brainwashed in the process. I mean, all TV has a message to it. I mean, Vinny, if you were doing a TV show, you'd probably, even if it was just a soap opera, you would probably put messages in that would support your views on life, wouldn't you?
Dude, there are already subliminal messages embedded in the Vinny Eastwood show.
Yeah, we all do it. We all do it. I mean, in my books, Product Placement, Freedom from Conscience. in those books, I have things in there that are dealing with my personal psychology and philosophical view of life. I mean, every writer, I mean, who was it? George Orwell said that all art is propaganda. I mean, all art, whether it's painting, whether it's literature, whether it's TV shows, it's a propaganda message behind it.
And you've got to do it. Well, the thing is, you have to do it the right way. That's why they call it propaganda as opposed to impropaganda.
Yeah. If I'm trying to hit a highly educated audience that I know is just tuning into my show because it's a form of escape, then if I put in the kind of propaganda that is very easy when I'm dealing with maybe people who have, let's say, a high school education and they work 9 to 5.
Hold on one second. We're just coming to break right now, and we'll be back in just a tick. Ladies and gentlemen, please remember this is listener-supported. Donate at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I am no Superman, but I'm so talented with writing that I could write a script tonight. My very special guest is Michael Cross. Now, Michael, you were just in the middle of something about how you're embedding programming in to affect certain people in different social groups, like the 9-to-5ers, you know, the mildly educated. Please continue.
Yeah, I was just saying that when television is broadcast, there are different layers. Obviously, there's people that you're trying to aim your TV show at, people who have a, let's say, you know, they at least have a few years of college. And then there's people who, like I said, do the 9-to-5 jobs, you know, service jobs, manufacturing, if there's any of those left in the Western world anymore, those kinds of jobs. And if you were to play the kind of plots to the group that is the more educated, they would switch it off. They would see the propaganda. But the lesser educated the person is, the more likely they will just kind of accept it. And it becomes ingrained into the way they see life. And so, to me, that, again, I just want people to understand that all of society is based on this. Everything, you know, marketing, that's why I talk so much about Bernays, that if you become aware, then at least you're less likely to be influenced by it. But there's only a small percentage of people that seem to, A, be aware, and B, even want to be aware. It's like trying to pull someone out of the matrix. You know, a lot of them are going to fight and scratch. I have an article about Plato's Allegory of the Cave at my website. Again, product placement, michaelcross.net.
Oh, I thought the product there was Plato.
Yeah. But the thing is that Plato's Allegory of the Cave can easily be applied to society today. And we all experience where you're trying to say, well, hey, take a look at why we're doing such and such thing in the Middle East. Here's really what the agenda is. And they're looking at you like, well, they don't say that on the nightly news. I mean, how can you be right? I mean, if that was true, then it would be on the 6 o'clock news. You know? And some people will resist. Of course, then again, there are people out there who might be in the matrix, which you could give them information and show them about how they're being controlled and how psychopathic, basically, the power structures have become. And they will actually question society. But it's a hit and miss. You're not going to get all the people. A lot of people will, they just don't want to believe that they're being led along by, like, you know, the strings on a puppet, like in the Pinocchio series.
Who could blame him, Michael? I don't want to believe it, but unfortunately the facts contradict my beliefs.
Mm-hmm. But you're well informed, so, you know, you're... but you probably found that, right? You'll talk to people and they just give you that guy glassy-eyed look like, huh? You know, and they...
You cannot reason with somebody who starts calling you a conspiracy theorist. Like, basically, that's the end of the conversation. If they accuse you of being a conspiracy theorist or tell you to get your tinfoil hat, you know you're dealing with somebody whose mind control is embedded like a tick.
Hmm?
And they're not worth your time. Just throw in your information grenade, say one thing, and then walk away, and then hope like hell the fuse blows in their face later on when somebody mentions it in an appropriate time in their life, probably when they're getting exterminated in a concentration camp and be too late. But today, that's not your fault.
Well, I mean, nowadays, I think what they call soft kill is better. I mean, there was some big spokesman for the United Nations recently that said we really need to reduce population in the world. And ultimately, it's easy to do. Just program things to where you show the heroine of a TV series or something, show all the female heroes as being the ones who well, you know, my career means more than this love interest, so I'm going to abandon my fiance and go on with my career. And you'll get plenty of young women going, yeah, that's what I want to do, and, you know, forego. I mean, that's just kind of an easy soft kill of a population. Just get them persuaded not to reproduce, and you got it. And, you know, those kinds of things, or get people to, I don't know, I've often wondered if the fertility rate in the United States is lower because people are so, the obesity is going, what's it like in New Zealand? Is the obesity rate the same way as it is in the United States or England?
Roughly, and I think we have between a 50 and 100% chance of developing cancer as well. Fluoride in the water, the endocrine disruptor, it'll cause weight gain, docile behavior. It'll also lower fertility remarkably. So it's kind of like it's just the gift that keeps on giving.
You know, it's really weird. Why is it that fluoride, I mean, if you look at a map of where fluoride is in the water, I mean, that's not one of the issues I usually take on, but it's the United States, Canada, England, and you say New Zealand, but it's banned in places like Scandinavia and in...
And 96% of Europe.
Yeah, Russia, China, they don't put fluoride in the water.
Exactly. That's why New Zealand buys its fluoride from China. Is it pharmaceutical grade, you ask? No. It's got about 18 other contaminants like cadmium and barium and goodness knows whatever mother effium. And they just dump it in the water in sacks, right, into these little decanters. And the people doing it was quite funny. We had a little debate on the breakfast program. A friend of mine, Mary Byrne from the New Zealand Fluoride Action Network, she's on the show, and while she's talking about the dangers of fluoride and everything, they have stock footage of this dude in a hazmat suit with these sacks that say level 6 biotoxin on them, direct from China, just dumping it into the water supply. And people don't click. They can see it right there, but it doesn't click because the programming's too embedded. If you say safe and effective enough, people will think anything is the best thing since sliced bread.
It's like in America, you have a lot of things that are like 99% sugar, junk food, but it'll on the packaging, it'll say in big, bold letters, fat-free, because technically there is no fat in it. It's sugar, but people don't put together that, okay, well, sugar that's not used in your body gets converted to fat. You know, the product originally had no fat. And, you know, the irony is that when it comes to fluoride, for instance, you don't have fluoride in Chinese public water systems, but yet they sell it to places like New Zealand, it seems. So,
well, it's because there's a vagary in International Uniform Commercial Code that if you're selling chemicals, and this is quite a reasonable law, if you're selling hazardous chemicals to another company, then that hazardous chemical is no longer classified under law as a hazardous chemical, is now classified as a product, a product of the ownership of a company. Now, that's supposed to be used for when you, of course, got caustic cleaning products or something of that nature in industrial uses, but what's happening is they're figuring out that they can sell toxic fluoride that's got all sorts of other additives, etc., as I said before, to local city councils, and then it's classified as a product, and then it's legal to dump a product, but it isn't legal to dump toxic waste.
Right, because it's got another classification. I guess if you were selling carbonated urine as a beverage, it would not be a human waste anymore. It would be a beverage because someone else was buying it.
Yeah, and besides, people will buy anything these days if the marketing's right. Like, I guarantee you, I could release an energy drink that had a skull and crossbones on it, a biohazard warning, and call it poison. And people would drink it, like it, and get another one. You know, I'll put in everything, man. I'll put in the aspartame. I'll put in the refined sugar. I'll put in the Monsanto GMOs. Everything you want, bro. And I will put it clear in labels and everything on it, and people will think it's cool.
Oh, don't forget the packaging. You should have lots of bisphenol chemicals in it as well.
I mean, that just goes without saying. And not to mention, you need to line the inside of the can with a thin film of bisphenylalanine plastic wrapping. You know, it'll be like Christmas.
It just seems people again. There's a okay, I'll use America as an example because I've never been in New Zealand, not yet. I hear there's a lot of rich people that are moving to New Zealand, you know, in case that there is a collapse.
Yeah, one of my listeners asked me the other day, so Vinny, how expensive is farmland in New Zealand? And I said, well, let me put it like this. The only people who seem to be able to afford it are large Chinese conglomerates and James Cameron.
Okay, well, they'll be okay when things collapse. But if you look at the United States, There is like three classes of people, I would say. There's the people that shop only natural stuff like organics and so forth, which used to be a really small fringe of the population. If you were in, I guess, California or Oregon, I'm from there, people that's more common. But if you were to go to Mississippi, you know, I don't know if you'd find so many organic eateries. However, there has been, because of probably alternative media, there is a large number of people now that are demanding organic and non-GMO. And even though they're not that second group of people who are newcomers to it, they're not like a giant groundswell. At least there's hope that when you educate people, they will start, you know, a lot of them will actually start gravitating towards something healthy. But then there's a large mass of people, and they may even be the majority. And they'll be, you know, their idea of a healthy lunch is a corn dog with some, you know, a couple liters of diet soda mixed with it, because that's the healthy thing if you're going to eat the corn dog, and, you know, a donut.
Clearly.
And they don't seem to care. I mean, and if you take, yeah, and you know, marketers know that these people will buy it if you put more sugar in it. More additives, more corn syrup, those kinds of things. Throw in all the GMOs you want.
What was that artificial sweetener that they had? It was like a flavor enhancer or something. It's in a lot of Chinese products. I forget what.
Saccharin?
No. It's like a real toxic one, but it makes everything you put in it taste so freaking good that it's unbelievable.
Oh, no. I know what it is because I was just in China. I mean, they serve it at you can sprinkle it on your food at the dinner table. It's MSG.
MSG. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But at least in China, you can add it to your. It's up to you when you're at the dinner table, you know, in a restaurant.
It's optional. It's not prepackaged in the food.
Yeah. And you can add it at your discretion. I mean, I guess you can add that stuff to the worst bland food ever, and it'll be just like wonderful type of thing. But that's added in the United States. MSG is everywhere, so it's not optional.
I mean, that's another thing is for a country that prides itself on consumer choice, the consumers really haven't got one, do they? Toxin is everywhere, poison is everywhere, carcinogens are everywhere. It's unavoidable. You actually have to research for years and go over a long, slow process of relocation, reevaluation, changing all of your habits in order to be even partially free of how toxic the food and water supply is alone.
Yeah, well, the irony is, when at least when it comes to food, I'm not going to vouch for water because a lot of the countries, you don't really want to drink the water. You got to drink bottled water when you're in those countries. But when it comes to food, there's quite a few countries that they require labeling. And these could be countries ranging from, you know, Russia. Well, they're really strict against GMO now. But China, the European Union, all the countries in the European Union are very strict about labeling your products. And what country can you not let, you know, do the companies fight tooth and nail if you try to label the product? And that is the United States. It seems to me that if you're proud of your product, you should, you know, it should say this is GMO, the, you know, brand new, you know, whatever, you know, be proud of it. Take possession of it. But no, in the United States, you have large corporations that will be fighting you if you try to put the label, okay, here's how much of this is GMO. And then of course, you got to wonder, you know, what is the health risk of using GMO? Personally, I don't care if you put an octopus gene into a tomato, because I can eat an octopus, I can eat a tomato. But when you start mixing around these kind of pesticides into the grains and stuff, that scares me.
It's going out of control, like Roundup Ready soybeans coming to a farm that is going to be repossessed near you. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week for your listening pleasure. Speaking of escapism, I like the fact that there's sugar in fruit. It makes the fruit sweet. What I like more is that it also comes with a lot of fiber, which disables the poisonous aspects of the super sweet sugar in the fruit. You package the poison with the cure. Think of this show as a form of curing your mind of fear, anger, anguish, that kind of thing, by having a few laughs about it with some incredibly bad jokes. They're the only thing that is worse than my jokes is the truth. And we're going to give you the truth, which will hurt you. It probably will. And if the truth hasn't made you suffer somewhat, you probably haven't digested the pill fully yet. Don't take the blue pill, take the red one, and then you can go to a laser dance party. My very special guest is Michael Cross. Welcome back. We've been talking about psychopaths. Now, this is often the depressing topic, and I like to, sometimes at the end of the show, ask my guests about how they actually deal with this sort of reality that they face on a day-to-day basis as sort of a career. Getting into the mindset of this can sometimes be inherently stressful, especially dealing with these kind of people face-to-face. And what do you do for your escapism, if there is any at all?
Well, ultimately, my form is, well, writing. I find writing very cathartic. And so, yeah, the idea that in my books, though, the series Freedom from Conscience, which is a wordplay, instead of it being Freedom of Conscience, which everyone thinks, oh, that's so wonderful and everything. Freedom from Conscience is the perspective of the heroine of the book, who finds it a strength to go up against people who are evil and be able to win in the end. So again, it's kind of like the whole Clint Eastwood Western, you know, where he's the anti-hero or whatever. And this allows you to explore, you know, fiction allows you to explore these kinds of subjects in a detached way, but also readers can at least read about this in, again, in a detached way, but in an emotional way. And so they can see how it really works in the real world. If you have just a textbook about psychopathy, it can be very dry. Someone reads it, okay, here's the 20 characteristics, and here's how they score, and how is this affected here, here, and here. But ultimately, I think it's fiction that, and people that, like you said, TV programmers know this, fiction's very powerful with people. It reaches you on an emotional level, not, you know, so much the intellectual. But that's where most people operate, in their emotions, which is a good thing, because if we didn't have emotions, we'd all be psychopaths. So,
well, you know, some would argue that's just a matter of time, depending on how powerful these criminal scumbags tend to get. Speaking of which, how is that working for humanity? Has this happened before, where really, really nasty psychopaths get in charge of the majority of stuff and then they get overthrown? Or is this actually the first time that we've faced a truly kind of global, interconnected, mind control, highly technologically advanced threat, and we might not even frickin' stand a chance against these people?
Well, I think that ultimately you can look at ancient history. I mean, this is something that happens all the time. Personality disorders and so forth have existed ever since day one, and they will continue to exist. There's positive aspects to each of them, and there's negative aspects to each of them. Maybe the people who are the major explorers of the world, maybe they were psychopathic. They were like, I'm going to do this. And when everyone was going, no, it won't work, they're going, yeah, I don't care what you say, I'm going to do it anyway. And they did it. They were the trailblazers. But if we take a look at, like, for instance, Roman history, I mean, people like Caligula, people like Nero, definitely psychopathic. I mean, without a doubt, psychopathic. Then you look at maybe other people like Vlad Tepes, I don't pronounce that name, the guy they made Dracula over, you know, Vlad the Impaler. If you look at his life and how he behaved, he was a psychopath, but at the same time, he was able to prevent the invasion from the Ottoman Empire into Europe. So maybe there were some good things about him being in the place he was. But ultimately, if you look at today, we don't have isolated, you know, worlds. We don't have the Roman Empire, but still you had the rest of the world. You don't have Transylvania and then, you know, the rest of the world. We now have an interconnected world in which technology not only is lets everyone see what's going on and connects everyone and allows, you know, various policies to be thrown at everyone at once, but we also are coming up on an era in which, you know, we're going to be the ones who are in charge of such things as our very biology through genetic engineering. I'm not talking about, you know, an apple, you know, where you breed an apple with a scorpion to get a better tasting apple or something. I'm talking about human beings are going to be designed, you know, at the genetic level in, you know, just a couple generations. I think that some of the predictions made that, you know, in Brave New World are going to come true. By the way, Huxley did not mean this as a warning like Orwell did in 1984. Brave New World was designed as a, hey, here's the future. And you're going to see more robotics come into play. And so the technology, you got to really keep an eye on who's making the laws now, because they're going to affect us at much deeper, profound levels than Bernays and propagandizing us to smoke or to eat bacon for breakfast.
Because that kind of stuff looks really, really cheesy by comparison. It's like when you watch 1940s special effects in 2015, you know, like, oh man, I can see through that easy. But you don't realize now that the stuff that you're watching in 2015 that looks so real, the propaganda has advanced just as much as that has. It's advanced alongside, almost like in a double helix type fashion, with entertainment. And it has been, in my opinion, weaponized.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because what you want is you want your population doing certain things and feeling certain ways. And just changing the word a little bit. News shows are not designed, for instance, with just someone sitting there, okay, let's write this up and put it on the teleprompter, this sounds good. No, every word and every wink of the eye that a newscaster gives as they're reading the teleprompter that's been designed for them has a purpose behind it. And if you doubt that, I mean, if you talk about, at least in America, the big national news people, the anchors who, yeah, their job is to sit there and either look pretty or look handsome and read off a teleprompter, why are they paid so much money? I mean, because they're serving a function for their corporation to sell the product, and that product can be what they're getting from the Defense Department. Oh, well, here, you know, we've got this information for you that you might find interesting. And, of course, that gets read and the people are expected to accept it as the truth. Oh, yes, we have to go, you know, we have to go take care of these people over here, but we're not going to mention the fact that this group here we funded and created 10 years earlier.
They're like football mascots for the status quo.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you use a football analogy. Think about that. You know, when you have these big, you know, at least American football games, You've got people that are making a large amount of money playing football, which, you know, used to be people just got together and played it for fun in their local communities. And now you got these players that are paid a lot of money to get out there and play, so they make the owners of the team rich by, you know, getting advertising deals and so forth. It's just like a huge corporation type thing. And it's not for the fun anymore. It's for
distraction.
Well, yeah, it's distraction. It's
bread and circuses, son.
Hey, the Gladiator games, I would not be totally surprised if at least if we, well, I, you know, if at least in the future when we have robots, then we'll have a reenactment.
We might have a reenactment. Okay. Are you still there, Michael?
Yes, I am right here.
Okay, sorry about that, but we're coming to break now. And I think we've covered a lot of ground during this show and produced a lot of analogies. I'm pretty anal about my analogies and my analysis. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Michael, for joining me. Google Michael Cross, ladies and gentlemen. It's good stuff. We'll see you again sometime.